meeting together. We had a quorum and we're ready to rock and roll. Minnesota Tourism, I think you're up first, Mr. Edmund.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is John Edmund, and I'm Director of Explore Minnesota Tourism. With your permission, I'd like to provide a brief overview of the budget for Explore Minnesota Tourism for the 06-07 biennium. First of all, just to kind of get a little bit of a setting for Explore Minnesota Tourism before I get into the specific budget numbers, our mission is just very simply to promote travel to and within the state of Minnesota. That's what we're all about. We're a $9 billion industry, and that's our mission. One of the things that's significant in terms of a background for the discussion of our budget is that we previously, as you may know, were part of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Last legislative session, tourism, which was the Office of Tourism, was transferred out of Employment and Economic Development to its separate organization, Explore Minnesota Tourism, in order to provide increased awareness of tourism, of the industry, and more partnerships with the private sector. One of the things that was created was an Explore Minnesota Tourism Council, which is a 28-person group consisting of representatives of various statewide organizations, resorts, hotels, restaurants, as well as four legislative members to help guide us in marketing tourism in Minnesota. Our budget has basically gone from an annual budget of about a high of $10 million per year in 2001, 75 FTEs, to our current budget of about $8 million and 49 FTEs. Now, this is just a very brief breakdown of our current $8 million budget. Our budget is broken down into advertising and marketing, $4 million. This is kind of the core of what we do in selling Minnesota. Our consumer services area is about $1.7 million. That's things like fulfillment of literature, brochures to consumers, our call center, our exploreminnesota.com website. Our partnership and grants and industry relations area is another major part of our budget. That's about $1.5 million. About half of that is grants to local tourism organizations to primarily promote Minnesota to non-residents. The grant program is about 10%. It has historically been about 10% of our budget over the last several years. And these grants are provided to communities on a 40% state, 60% local match. And then the last part of our budget is travel information centers of about $800,000. We actually have 12 state TICs. Only six of those are staffed with state tourism staff. We used to staff them all. But with budget cuts, we develop partnerships with local tourism organizations. So six of them are partnerships, six of them are with the state. And we also have 20 other travel information centers throughout the state that are affiliates, that are just other information centers that we use as distribution points for tourism information. Why we do what we do is because of the return on investment. It's a $9.2 billion industry in Minnesota. Tourism is, we often don't view it this way, but it's comparable to agriculture in terms of its importance. Contributes about $1 billion annually, state and local taxes. 230,000 jobs, and these jobs are projected to grow about 19% over the next 10 years. And there's the obvious return on investment. For every dollar that we invest in tourism, we provide $4.60 back to the state in new state and local taxes, $20.40 in wages, and $53 in gross sales. Now, to the heart of the budget for the biennium. Currently, we're at about $16.1 million for the biennium. The governor's recommendation is $16.2 million. And it's not to say that it's totally a flat. There are a number of significant changes in the budget proposal for Explore Minnesota Tourism, which I'd like to discuss with you right now. The three changes are in the areas of the public-private enhancement funding. This is a new source of funding for Minnesota tourism that reflects the concept of partnerships of $1 million. There's a base budget transfer from DEED to Explore Minnesota Tourism of $1.1 million. This is for things like rent and fiscal and HR and those types of things, and I'll go into that in a little greater detail. And then there's also a base budget reduction of $2 million, but if you add all of this up, we're at about 16.2 for the biennium compared to 16.1, which is where we are starting. Now, the big change is the public-private enhancement funding. And what this is the supplemental funding that will impact our budget beginning in 07. Very simply, what this says is that Explore Minnesota Tourism, we have to generate $4 million cash or in kind from the private sector. That's in order to get the partnerships. Then for every dollar that we generate above that $4 million, we get another dollar from the general fund with a cap of $1 million. It's not a guarantee that we get this, but what this basically says, it's an incentive. It rewards partnerships. It positions us as an agency to go out and to develop marketing partnerships with the private sector. And if we do that, then we can be rewarded. But it's not just simply saying we want additional general fund dollars. We want these new partnership dollars. And this was something that was developed with the industry as an alternative to grow Minnesota tourism. Now, this strategy, it's one part of our budget. It's not the entire budget. But it's
Mr. Edmund, just out of curiosity, we contribute money in what form?
Well, that can be either cash or in kind. That can be cash, Mr. Chairman, that's contributed for sales missions, for fam tours, the cash that they put into publications, cash that they put into the website. Or it could be in kind. As an example, if we leverage dollars on a fall promotion to promote fall travel in Minnesota with Holiday Gas Stations, and Holiday Gas Stations then uses some of their money to also sell Minnesota tourism. So then we track that those match dollars, and that's what we tally as a part of that private match. So that becomes part of that $4 million, which is the threshold that we have to get. That's the bare minimum we have to get, and then for anything above that, then that's where the reward comes in.
Thank you. Representative Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, along those lines as well, let's say we get over that $4 million, so we've got that extra million that you can match, then how do we spend that money? Where does that, tell me how that's spent, and does it go with those people that are providing the matching dollars, or what?
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative, that would specifically be for marketing purposes. The idea of this is that we wouldn't want to use it just for administration. We'd want to use it as new money to sell Minnesota. And it could be used for a variety of different things. It could be used for marketing spring-summer. It could be used for fall. It could be used for scenic byways. But the dollars that we'd receive from this enhancement wouldn't necessarily be tied to where the private match dollars came from. Because there's a wide variety of different sources, and some of them pretty small, actually. But they all add up.
So in other words, when I advertise my business, it counts towards your $4 million if I was in the tourism business?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Can you call my grocery store part of the tourism business? I advertise about $150,000 a year. Can we add that to that?
Mr. Chairman, no, we can't. Only if it's specifically tied.
Some people in Iowa think I'm a pretty good tourist attraction. We can travel over 50 miles to get there.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's just specifically tied to the dollars that we invest in a program. I mean, later we can talk. I have a deal for you. But if I'll put money in for tourism into a state of Minnesota promotion, and you put money in as well to your grocery store, and then we can count that. But that's the idea. It's leveraging the dollars from the state to get more out of it from the private sector. As I was mentioning, this is a part of a longer-term strategy to grow tourism, and it's something that came out of some listening sessions we had all throughout the state last year, where we we talked about different alternative funding scenarios, and this was the one that really spoke mostly to the new structure for tourism, that we are now a partnership organization. It's really leveraging dollars from the state and from the private sector that basically rewards partnership and increases the private sector's involvement in state tourism marketing. This is to the question regarding match. It's defined as revenue to the state or documented cash expenditures directly expended to support Minnesota tourism programs. I think in your budget book it says that there's about $3 million in special revenue funds that would be generated, but not all of that is necessarily revenue, and that will be clarified in writer language. The way that we measure this match is we do partnerships. We monitor that annually. We always have to document that we actually get this match, but it's legitimate dollars that are contributed for Minnesota tourism purposes, so we have a record, and we establish a variety of agreements to determine these marketing relationships and, again, to document that match. As I mentioned, we had listening sessions throughout the state, and we did consider a wide variety of other sources. We were basically challenging the industry to come up with different ways, innovative ways, to fund tourism that isn't totally reliant on general funds. And we did talk about gaming revenues. We talked about lodging tax. We talked about performance-based funding, Missouri models, car rental fees, etc. During the time of last year when we had these listening sessions, there wasn't enough consensus on any one of these items, so the public-private enhancement seemed to be the best fit as one method now to try to grow tourism in a different way. But we are going to be continuing that discussion about different funding alternatives. We've just announced a series of listening sessions. I think we're calling them tourism growth meetings, where we're having strategic planning all throughout the state of Minnesota over the next 6 months with stakeholders to look at strategies for funding, what we should be doing in marketing, what are the key issues in product development. And we're looking to develop some long-range strategic plan, not just for the next year of the biennium, the next 5 or 10 years.
Representative Clark's got a question.
Mr. Chair, I just was wondering how this initiative would impact cultural tourism. I don't see anything in here that really, or heritage tourism, whatever you call it, I don't see anything in here that really talks about that, and this has been something over the years that the agency used to have as a priority. And I'm thinking the issue of match makes it a little difficult for particularly those really needy, low-income tourist sites that are, you know, that bring the cultural diversity out. So can you speak to that just briefly?
Well, sure, Mr. Chairman, Representative, cultural heritage tourism is a key part of our strategy. If you look at our current strategic plan, promoting cultural heritage tourism is a part of our 05 strategic plan. I don't think you have a copy of it there, and I'd be glad to get you a copy of our cultural heritage tourism plan. There's actually someone here in the audience that works quite a bit on cultural heritage tourism, and maybe, Colleen, if you could just speak very briefly to some of the things that we're currently doing, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, about cultural heritage, because it is important. As to your question regarding the match, we're not necessarily looking to small businesses, organizations, to really make the bulk of this. We do a lot of different activities right now in generating match from all different areas, and that's really the sum total of what we're doing. We're not necessarily going to be penalizing anyone for their inability to bring into the match. But Colleen Tollison is my industry relations manager that also works quite a bit on cultural heritage tourism. And Colleen, maybe if you could just briefly...
Well, welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record so the Historical Society behind you will know you were there.
I'm Colleen Tollison with Explore Minnesota Tourism. And actually, one of our bigger cultural heritage tourism efforts is an interagency effort with the Historical Society, with the State Arts Board, with DNR State Parks, and then with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And our Our primary funding for that is through federal funding, through the Scenic Byways Program, and we did just in the last 6 months receive $280,000 in Federal Highway Administration funding for Scenic Byways promotion, which is one of our major projects. And that's our primary cultural heritage component. The piece that we promote is the 22 byways throughout the state of Minnesota. It includes the Grand Rounds, which is more in the metropolitan area, the Mississippi River, and it's throughout the state. We haven't fully completed our marketing plan, but that's intended to be used for about the next 2 years to do scenic byways and cultural heritage promotion. Then another piece that we just completed is primarily for the international market, is a newsletter that we'll be using at ITB Berlin and other locations, and that focuses on Native American heritage and other things that really work well within the international marketplace. The other primary thing that we do from a cultural heritage standpoint is through our publications like the Minnesota Explorer newspaper. We try to be very balanced in terms of the areas that we promote. With, I think almost every issue has a pretty large article focusing on cultural heritage.
Representative Clark.
Okay, so I think what I understand is, the areas that would be classified, I guess, as cultural heritage don't necessarily have to raise the match themselves. It comes from some federal dollars, and I don't know, scenic byways is that federal highway funding, did you say? And so it has a lot to do with more greater Minnesota, I suppose, and the use of the Grand Rounds. But it's along roads rather than, for example, inside metro areas or regional cities or...
The Grand Rounds, for the metropolitan area, the other thing that does go on is that the Twin Cities has a tourism promotion group. We call it the Metro Committee, and that's the 13 convention and visitor bureaus throughout the metro area, and they pool their money, and one of the kind of requirements or things that they've kind of set out for their own goals is to constantly include the cultural heritage aspects of the Twin Cities, with sports, shopping, some other things, but that's one of their key areas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to say, I know you've really worked very well with communities throughout the state, so thank you for your leadership. And I'm glad we're still holding on to it. I just didn't see it anywhere in here, and I was wondering if we're still getting funded.
The funds have been cut, so they've got to cut back in their ink.
I see.
Mr. Edmund.
Just briefly, some of the impact of the other changes. There is a $2 million base budget reduction in the proposed budget that I mentioned earlier, and this will be partially offset by the new enhancement funding and the base transfers. We've also, over the last several years, we've had a number of vacancies that we have not filled in anticipation of budget realities, and so that's allowed us to absorb some of these this base reduction. We use some revenue to fund certain programs and prioritize other efforts. The $1.1 million base budget transfer, I'm sure Matt Kramer wouldn't like to see a billion transfer to me. The $1.1 million base budget transfer is to cover rent, IT, communications, research, HR, and fiscal services that were previously paid for by deed. Those were, if you really want to go back in the Minnesota Office of Tourism budget, we used to have funds in our budget for these services, for fiscal, for rent, for administration costs. Those were transferred way back to the Department of Trade and Economic Development and then into deed. The amount that's being transferred back to us is actually substantially less than what was taken out. But this will allow us some flexibility to provide those services. We're able to do it in some cases at hopefully less cost than we're currently providing. We're talking to the Office of Technology in order to find alternative ways to provide our technology needs. But basically, the $1.1 million base budget transfer is to cover some of those expenses. basically, in conclusion, we're now a new organization, Explore Minnesota Tourism. We're no longer part of DEED. We're positioned in a new way. And again, the public-private enhancement funding is a key change in the 06-07 budget for Explore Minnesota Tourism. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any additional questions.
Ms. Edmund, this in-kind advertising various tourism venues do, is there any requirement that they also use Explore Minnesota Tourism's logos and stuff like that in there in order to qualify? Is there any way that they perhaps, when they advertise their own business, they globally advertise the rest of Minnesota somehow?
Mr. Chairman, when it relates specifically to our grant program, our $750,000 grant program where we provide 40% of the cost, yes, we do require, we have requirements for that program, requirements that it primarily be used to attract non-residents to Minnesota and that they do, in fact, use the Explore Minnesota logo. We're right now looking at updating our logo, our Explore Minnesota logo, to give more, a little bit modern look to it, but also to really emphasize the state of Minnesota. And as a part of that, we, whether it's grant program or not, we think that it's very advantageous if we're all basically promoting the same brand. And so, yes, there is requirements as far as the grant program, but in the cases where we can't tie it to dollars, we're still going to be encouraging that as well.
Mm-hmm. How much of our advertising marketing efforts are going, let's say, in other states like Iowa and South North Dakota? How much do we promote our tourism venues in those markets? You know, there's a theory in southern Minnesota that everybody goes north 200 miles. So you barely qualify. We go to your area. But basically, they go 200 miles, and that brings a lot of Iowa bullhead fishermen into my area. Is there any effort to measure that? Where do our tourists come from?
Well, first of all, the question regarding where our advertising dollars go, I think it probably also reflects where the tourists come from. But our advertising dollars, about 60 to 65% go to attract non-residents to Minnesota versus promoting to residents. We've actually done more to promote to residents than we've ever done in the past. Since 9/11, people are traveling closer to home, and we want to keep those dollars circulating in the economy. But it's the non-residents that provide the biggest return on investment. They stay longer, they spend more money. And so that's where we put the majority of our dollars. Where, to the question of where do we market, it's primarily in the north central region of the U.S. And we're talking about the Dakotas, Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, Nebraska, and that are in Canada as well. That's where the bulk of our advertising dollars go. In spring, summer of this year, we're going to be actually going into Chicago and Milwaukee more heavily than we've ever done before. We're doing that because we're not producing new television. We're using some of our old television, and we're getting in Chicago, which is an important market for us, but it's very expensive. So we'll be there, though, for the first time in a long time this year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe in advertisement. I do a lot of my own business. The chair said he spends $150,000 a year, so I really believe it works. But can you explain to me, first of all, how we get the number $4.60 for every dollar? I believe in it, but I don't know how you get the data, and I'm just curious to see.
Mr. Edmund.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, very good question. Basically, what we do is it's a part of a survey. It's a conversion return on investment study that we do specifically tied to our advertising. So we do some advertising to attract people to Minnesota. They contact us. Then we go back to those people and say, did you receive the information from Explore Minnesota Tourism? Did you actually take a trip that you would not, did it influence you to travel? And did you take a trip that you would not have otherwise taken to Minnesota? Then we go and ask them, how much did you spend on your trip? How much did you spend on hotels, on restaurants, et cetera, as well as you calculate the tax contribution? Then you compare that specifically to the dollars that you spent to get those consumers. And then you do the calculations, and for these dollars that we spent, just the advertising dollars, for the advertising dollars that we spent, and then we look at how many people actually traveled and what they spent as a result of it, that's how you get the $4.60 in state and local taxes returned for every dollar that we spent. We used to actually have a 10-to-1 figure when we included the federal tax contribution portion, but we took that out, so it's like a lower figure.
So, Mr. Chair, so, you know, I offered legislation for more money for tourism because I believe that it can quickly generate more taxes back to us. But in your opinion, at least I'm pitching you a softball here, if we gave more money to tourism and they spent more advertising, would it generate more? In other words, is there a point where, you know, too much advertisement just doesn't do any good, and where are we on that level? In other words, you know, would a few million dollars more or $10 million more, would that have significant impact for your industry?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, I obviously believe in the concept of the return on investment, or that I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. I believe that sometimes when you talk about tourism, and it shouldn't be on an expenditure line as much as it should be on a revenue line, because it brings dollar back to the state. In terms of how much is the right amount for tourism, it's I guess that question is something that you have to answer relative to your budget issues and state budget priorities. But one way to look at it is where you stand next to the competition. And when you look at our major competitors, if you look at Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, even South Dakota, they all spend more to sell tourism than we do here in Minnesota. So that might be a gauge to take a look at if you're looking to try to make us even with our competitors. In fact, even Wisconsin Dells spends more money than we do, which is kind of surprising.
Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. In looking at the information in the book, too, here, advertising and marketing, you know, is spent on print media, television, and radio, direct mail, electronic partnership marketing. I want to thank you for this brochure and all this information. I find it very helpful. But do you have any pie charts showing that what percentage you spend on those different items of marketing, and then also the net effect of how that money is spent? I mean, what are the results of it?
Mr. Edmund.
Mr. Chair, Representative, actually right now I don't have a pie chart on that. I can get that breakdown for you on the balance between television, radio, direct mail. We have measurements for each of our specific tactics, whether it's goals on the direct mail. We do conversion studies on various tactics. In fact, this year we're doing something we haven't done recently is some studies on the impact of television advertising, because television advertising is one of those things that's a little bit hard to get your hands on. You're promoting the concept of Minnesota. Sometimes a consumer will see that and they may contact a Grandview or an Arrowwood directly and not even touch us. So how do you know if you're really having an impact? Because a lot of what we measure is when the consumer touches us. When I was talking earlier about the return on investment, that's people that call us or write us. But all it doesn't, in that return on investment, factor in when people go to our website. Our website, sometimes we don't get the name. Well, we don't get the names. They go right there, and sometimes they link over into another community. So we have different measurements for each tactic. We're constantly trying to reevaluate, and I don't have one specific chart that I can give you, but I can get you some additional information on the breakdown of where those dollars go for various campaigns.
Okay, and I can see where it'd be hard to quantify those results, but I have to tell you, I really like the commercials that you guys did with Craig and the boat. I don't know if you remember those little canoe commercials where he was, I think those were through Explore Minnesota.
Craig Kilbourne?
Yeah, those are fantastic. So, the other question I have is, in going through this brochure here, it's got top destination in the state of Minnesota is the Twin Cities metro area. And when you look at the top activities for travelers in the state of Minnesota, the top three are scenic touring, visiting friends and family, and shopping.
rated though.
And I'm guessing this probably has a lot to do with the Mall of America, but my question for you is, in going through the different activities here, I noticed that there aren't any sports activities, and I think of the state of Minnesota as a sports mecca, you know, with the Vikings, the Twins, the Wild, and the Timberwolves and that type of thing, and I'm just curious, do you do any tracking of travelers who come here for sporting events?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's included in some of the statistics. It is a little buried in terms of the fact that that's why a lot, almost half of the travelers to Minnesota come to the metropolitan area, and that's something that's often lost when you talk about tourism. Most people think tourism is just a few resorts up in northern Minnesota. Mm-hmm. But the metropolitan area, I don't have the exact numbers here in front of me, it's something like 40-some percent of the travelers to Minnesota come to the metro area, and they come here for things like sports, for the arts and the culture and the restaurants and the conventions and those types of things. Some of our convention visitors bureaus might have some of that more detailed, how the sports piece fits in there. But clearly, that is one of the reasons that people come to Minnesota. And it's actually very big right now in winter. Winter's a very long season. Very hard to market when you can't depend on snow. And a lot of people come to Minnesota, the metropolitan area, for the arts, for sports, and those kinds of things. So it's a huge part of what we have to offer in Minnesota.
I think it's one of those things where if we're going to market Minnesota and that's the top destination and those are the biggest things, that we should, you know, have a real strong emphasis on marketing those things in particular. So, thank you.
Representative Smalley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director, I had a question. I'm sorry, I was late, so I maybe you covered this, and I don't want to be redundant from the numbers. I apologize. About business travel, I read recently that Disney had their convention in Minnesota and for their stockholders, their annual meeting. Is how aggressive are we about trying to recruit groups like that and then marketing to them, you know, tacking on a couple days and spending money? Because they said, you know, something like that will generate an enormous amount of revenue in a short period. Do you, I'm sure you're on here, your horizon, you could tell us the next 50 conventions you're going to be competing for, but do we directly compete for those? Is your office involved in that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, we work very closely with the Convention and Visitors Bureaus. They often take the lead in bringing conventions to Minnesota. And some of the individual conventions, we don't necessarily get in part because it's sometimes competitive. You have different cities that are competing for the same conventions. But we do get involved with the Convention and Visitors Bureaus on some of the larger conventions, like ASAE was a big one here last summer, whereas we work with CVBs throughout the entire state to not only get people to Minnesota, to get them to extend their stay. So some of the larger ones, yes, we do work with the CVBs to help sell the state as a whole. But a lot of the convention marketing in Minnesota is done through like the Minneapolis, St. Paul, Bloomington, Duluth Convention Visitors Bureaus.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. And I just piggybacking off of Representative Gazelka, that I do think there is a saturation point sometimes, and when it is efficient for advertising, I serve on the audit commission, and I know with gambling, in fact, we felt that we were, you know, we found that we were spending way more than we were able to bring in. So I'm glad to see that you're really, you know, watching that and looking at the return on the investment. But then, too, I just really wanted to encourage you to spend it freely on encouraging people to come to Owatonna, to Cabela's, and some American Wasika.
This government is the government helps me more than my neighbor. It works every time.
But these are worthwhile, Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark's got a lot of people coming visiting right next to her district, too. It's called the Metrodome.
Yes.
And the convention center. So with that, that 4.7 times is an increase in revenue dollars that you generate. For every dollar spent from state taxpayers' dollars, it brings back $4 and how many cents?
60 cents.
60 cents into the Department of Revenue. It's not leveraging, it's leveraging that many dollars back. So it's a 400 and some percent gain. Is that correct?
That is correct.
You know, it's very important to look at those things. Tourism is you know, you got agriculture, you got tourism. Some people say Indian gambling is one of the biggest economic generators in the state. Where do they rate? Is tourism second?
Well, I think,
or is agriculture second?
We've had that discussion, Mr. Chairman, internally, and it's difficult sometimes to get a specific numerical ranking. We look at it, though, in terms of contributions to gross domestic product. And if you look at the contribution to the state's gross domestic product of tourism, it is on par with agriculture. Now, where agriculture and tourism fit in a numerical ranking, I'm not exactly sure. But it is comparable in terms of the $9 billion that it contributes to our economy every year.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, thank you for a good report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next we have the Minnesota Historical Society. Welcome again. While we're getting set up, what we're going to cover tomorrow is mediation services, Work Comp Court of Appeals, PUC, and the Barbers and Cosmetology Board. We have just a couple more overviews, and then we're starting to get a fairly substantial number of bills in, so we'll start going into bills. So with that, welcome to our committee.
Chairman, my name is Nina Archibald. I'm director of the Minnesota Historical Society, and I really appreciate the opportunity to come before you today. A number of the members of the committee are fairly familiar with the Society's program, have engaged us in various ways, and have sat for a number of years on this committee. But there are also some new members, and so we want to take the opportunity today to give you a brief overview of our activity as you begin to approach the really back and forth stages of your budget deliberations. The way things will work this morning is that I'll give you an overview of the Society's program, and then my colleague David Kelleher, who's sitting here at my right, will go through the budget pages, and together we'll try to answer some questions. I should encourage you, as you go, to ask us questions. We're happy to. You don't need to wait till the end to hold all your questions, certainly. You have in your materials a folder that does have the narrative for the PowerPoint, but I do not believe in reading PowerPoints to you, and so it's just a way of kind of keeping track of where we are and perhaps even noting some questions as we go. If I were to describe the Society, one could describe it in many ways, but I would describe it first and foremost as an educational institution. But we are also a significant driver for commerce in the state, and we certainly should be of interest to you in terms of what is clearly your strong interest in economic development in the state. We had an interesting presentation on tourism in the state, and it did occur to me that I certainly am well aware that the Society is a major driver for cultural tourism, and while we think of ourselves as an educational institution, we certainly give our tourism folks something to market that's very powerful and very attractive to visitors to the state. As creators of the state's history museum at the History Center, I hope all of you will, if you've not already been there, that you'll take the time to go, and of the new Mill City Museum in Minneapolis, a wonderful development in which we have walked hand in hand with the Convention and Visitors Association over there, not only in its development but in its promotion. But we also serve as stewards and storytellers at our historic sites across Minnesota. Clearly, the Society is a major player in the area of cultural tourism. The Society is the oldest institution in Minnesota. It was the first institution created by the first territorial legislature in 1849, and we are guided by our territorial charter, both the 1849 document and revisions to it that were made later in 1856. We were chartered as a private institution created clearly from the beginning for a public purpose. Today, we are governed by a 30-member governing board that is elected by our membership. We have a membership of 17,000 members from across the state of Minnesota. It is the largest membership of any state historical society in the nation. We've been close to the state, actually, since the days of our founding. Our first offices were in the first state capitol building, and the first territorial governor, Alexander Ramsey, was the first president of the society, and he was a shaker and mover, certainly behind its creation. And over the years, we have been guided by the state. Indeed, you will find much of our activity described in Minnesota Statutes 138, and I refer those to you to really get a different kind of state overview of what the society does on behalf of the state of Minnesota. We've had a very clear and unchanging mission for the last 156 years. What's changed has been the methods by which we implement this mission, but not the real purpose. I wasn't going to read the PowerPoint, but the mission I am going to read. The mission of the Minnesota Historical Society is to foster among people an awareness of Minnesota history so that they may draw strength and perspective from the past and find purpose for the future. I always think of the society as being future-oriented. I would personally not be interested in it if it were only a matter of somehow celebrating the past and not connecting it to the future. We preserve the stories and the evidence of the past so that people will have a basis to shape the future. And we get questions constantly as people deal with public policy issues, even today, that clearly people are looking for information about how we got to this point. Where we are, what were the decisions made earlier that have brought us to the moment of decision today. The Society delivers on its mission in many ways, providing opportunities for people of all ages. We're not like an elementary school dealing only with elementary school children. Although we deal with elementary school children, we deal with people of all ages and help them to learn about the state's past. We collect the material evidence, and we make it accessible to people, and the collecting goes on even as we speak. We encourage research, and when we say research, I don't want you to be thinking about test tubes and scientific labs. I want you to be thinking about trying to learn about the people of the past. People come to us, both the public, and we ourselves conduct research, which is the basis of our exhibitions, books, and other materials, interpretive programs that we prepare for the public. History does make a difference to the people of Minnesota, and we've got some buttons which are going to be coming around so that you all can walk around wearing your button like mine that says, History Matters. The Society does play a very important role in educating the state's people, both people who are new to the state, who have just come here. We take an active role in seeking out those newcomers and in educating, continuing the educating of those who have lived here for generations, people of all ages. But one of our real very strong target audiences is school children. They are especially important to us, and we address them in a variety of ways. Certainly among the most important is through the curriculum that we prepared called Northern Lights. And we have worked closely with the Department of Education, with the Commissioner, to develop standards for the teaching of Minnesota history that we think makes sense. And we have produced a curriculum which is used in the state schools. David Keller has a copy. It has a teacher's guide as well, and it is used, it will be used now with the passage of the new standards, I think, in even more of the state schools. I think there will be very few that will not be using it when all is said and done here. We also preserve the official records of Minnesota's government at all levels. We work with the governor's office. We preserve your records, the records of the Minnesota legislature, courts, health and welfare, corrections, right down to the township level. All the activity in which government is engaged. And I guess I want to reassure you at this moment that we do not preserve every piece of paper that is generated by government. There is a process by which we determine what are the significant, historically significant, permanently valuable records, and these are the kinds of materials that we preserve. This challenge of preserving these records, of course, is changing as the world becomes more electronic, and I say with some pride that the Society has just received a grant of about $250,000 to work with the records of the e-legislature to make sure that the electronic, as we move into the electronic age, that the record is there for the people in the future and that we're not simply relying on paper. We all know that less and less, well, at least I have enough paper that crosses my desk, but a lot of what happens certainly happens in electronic format. I mentioned that we contribute to the state's economy through cultural tourism, both people attracting people to travel to the state, and certainly travel from abroad is a piece of what we do. I just had a message yesterday from a colleague who is a German-American. He lives in Northfield but spent 6 months of the year in Germany. The history of our native people is of great interest to Europeans. This is an aspect of the past in which they do not participate directly. And so yesterday afternoon, my secretary said we'd get a call for a number of brochures, so if this fellow could take the materials back to Germany with him. And, of course, there is travel within the state, especially to the Historical Society's museums and to our historic sites everywhere. I would encourage you to put our materials in the glove box of your own car and when you're out traveling in the summer to find your way to some of these really important historic places that tell the story of the state. We also, by collecting materials, serve future generations who will be relying on us, who have will rely on us, who have preserved the evidence of today's Minnesota for their use in the future. I'm always interested when people say, well, gee, that's not history, that's my life. Well, your life is quickly becoming a part of history. It's today, it's yesterday, it's what we're doing at this very moment. The next thing that you will see is an organization chart, and I commend this to you for your later study if you wish, but it gives you an idea of how the Society is organized to do its work. And I might mention that those of you who've been around long enough to know our organization charts know that this one looks a bit simpler than they have in the past, and that's a result of the fact that in relation to the budget cuts that we have experienced recent past, we have gone from 21 departments down to 14 departments, and so there's been significant reduction there. What we're trying to do to take as much energy and intelligence as we can and to direct it at public service as opposed to administration. The program itself looks like this. We have a stewardship responsibility for 30 historic sites, places that we hold in trust for the people of Minnesota. 23 of those sites are open to the public and available for visiting. There are also two major museums, the State History Museum at the History Center and our new museum in Minneapolis, the Mill City Museum, which is a very attractive venue for travelers to the state as well as for people who live here. We do exhibitions. We produce exhibitions. You can come to the History Center or go to Mill City Museum and see them. There's a very interesting exhibition right there on transportation called Getting There. And if you think there's anything new under the sun, you can forget about it because you can come and see our exhibition on transportation and see the way in which people of the past have struggled with issues around transportation, how they have solved them, and how we even deal with them and the controversy that has surrounded them in recent years. So I do encourage you to come over and have a look at Getting There. Another topic of current interest is the American presidency. We've just come through a most interesting election, and we have an exhibition that is borrowed from the Smithsonian Institution and enhanced with examples from Minnesota, because Minnesota has certainly played a role in presidential politics. And so I would encourage you to get over and see that exhibition on the American presidency. It's very interesting. And because we always are timely, we open an exhibition this month called Happily Ever After about love and marriage. So you might come over and have a look at that as well for a little fun. Sometimes exhibitions take... you don't want to sign up for that one. Are you telling me, Mr. Mahoney, that you're really very good at love and marriage, or that you're... No. All right, Mr. Chairman.
It's rare that someone's made me speechless, but...
Please excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Sometimes our exhibitions take unusual form. As they did at the flour tower in Minneapolis, we essentially were working with a ruin of a flour mill, a mill that was just a pile of stone, and we brought that mill back to life in the exhibition in the flour tower, which is essentially a freight elevator with a theater inside of it that goes through the 8 floors of the mill, and in that experience, doing it, I think, better than Disney, that mill comes back to life and functions, and the people who once worked there, their voices speak to you as they remember what life was like when the General Mills, what was first the Washburn A Mill, functioned at full performance. We also operate the state's historical library, a massive amount of information. You probably think about us primarily for our historic sites and museums, but we collect massive amounts of materials. We have a very large library. We collect materials, we manage them, and we provide access to them. So getting them in is just the beginning of the process. We have to be able to have intellectual control of them so we can find them. And when you come asking for information, we can provide it to you and to anyone else who crosses our threshold. We also publish books, one of the earliest activities of the Society. The Society's not only been close to the state, but we have been close to the Smithsonian Institution as well. And we published actually our first book in 1852. The organization was only 3 years old, and it was a co-publication with the Smithsonian Institution, a Dakota English dictionary. Today, that publications program is a very aggressive program, producing everything from books that would go in your glove box to guide you in your travels in Minnesota to really more substantial books books you saw that are used in schools, books that are for a general adult audience, and books for a scholarly audience as well. And we not only sell them in Minnesota, we sell them nationally. Some of our books you may look at and see an imprint that doesn't say Minnesota Historical Society Press. It will say Borealis Books. And we did this because we discovered that book buyers in New York might not pick up a book that said Minnesota Historical Society Press, but they will pick up a book that says Borealis Books, because many of the subjects that we treat and books we publish are of great interest to people nationally.
Representative Flower.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Archibald, I used to work for the University of Arizona Press, so I just have a question about that. How is Borealis Books nonprofit? It's just a pseudo name that you market your books under?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's not a pseudo name. It's just another name under which we print. For example, a book like Minnesota Eats Out, which has had a lot sold very popularly, is under the Borealis Books. It's not a separate. It's still under our direct supervision. The publisher of Minnesota Historical Society Press is the publisher of it, so there's no for-profit spin-off or any such thing.
Okay, thank you.
We also have, and the books are coming around, some of them for you to have a look at. You'll get a range, everything from book about Minnesota's treasures, historic places. You also have the catalog, so you can get a look at it as well. To a book that we published, our head conservator, a rare breed of person and a rare scholar we have on our staff, has published a book guiding the care and collection of Indian artifacts, and that book is on the shelves of probably every major museum in the nation at this point. We also have responsibility for historic preservation in the state, and we get involved with counties, with cities, with local governments, local groups who are interested in historic preservation, and we carry out the preservation program, which is described in both federal and state law. So we are operating in both areas, fulfilling Minnesota's responsibility. Finally, we assist the county and local historical organizations. One of the things that has happened in Minnesota is because it has had a strong and diverse historical program at the state level, it has spawned a very strong program locally and in the counties. There are well over 400 county and local historical organizations who carry a major burden for history in the state. They appreciate our services. We publish a newsletter 6 times a year for them, work with them closely. But one of the things that they have appreciated most about our activity with them is that we have been making grants to them, grants of state and federal dollars, both out of general fund dollars and capital dollars, bond dollars as well. We've been doing that since the late 1960s. And I think we've been doing it on a matching basis. They've had to provide at least $1 for every dollar that we provide, the state dollars or federal dollars to them. But beyond that, and I think even more important, the standard of work has been raised because we've been able, when they come to us for a grant, to say, gee, you're thinking about putting whatever windows in that building. Historically, you should be really doing X, Y, or Z, and we provide guidance for them along the way. So I think the state gets a real bargain and the work gets done in a really high-level way. You also find yourself not having to respond to individual projects from your areas and districts, but rather can feed those projects through the grants program, and the result is almost always better than it would be otherwise. And we do archaeology at our Minnesota Historical Society sites where archaeology is needed, and we do contract archaeology for the Department of Natural Resources. Those of you who have visited national and state sites around the country know that very often in areas of great cultural beauty, there are also important cultural places. And so we manage the historic properties and work with DNR to make sure the archaeology is done to preserve the archaeological resources that are within the places under their care, state parks and beyond. Probably the way in which most of the state's people know us best is through our historic sites network. It is a large and very important part of our business. It is well defined in Minnesota Statutes 138.662. These are defined, what the state has determined, your predecessors have determined, are the most significant places in Minnesota. And you can see that they dot the state from one corner to the other. All of this that we do requires administrative support. It requires marketing and communication to let people know what we do so that they may take advantage of it. We also, through our development program, raise non-state dollars to supplement our state appropriation in significant ways, both through sponsorships and direct grants. We assist and work with the legislature, with the governor's office, with counties, with cities, and with local governments. And, of course, we have to do take care of the basic financial operations and human resources operations that any organization has as its responsibility. In our case, it's not only dealing with paid employees, but it's dealing with unpaid employees as well. We have some 1,500 volunteers who work with the society in any given year, and a number of those, I can't give you a specific number, but nearly work full-time, certainly not all 1,500, but the number of them who, day after they retire, show up at our doorstep and want to continue their work in library or wherever it is. To give you a sense of scale, this is a very big service operation. Some 600,000 people come to our sites each year. Some 400,000 come to the History Center. School children, about somewhere between 110 and 120,000 school children come registered for programs every year. You see them coming to the History Center. And if you look at the total system, we've got about 250,000 school children that we're providing direct service to who come to our historic sites or to the History Center. About 40,000 library patrons. Actually, that number is very small because the world has been transformed by the World Wide Web, and much of our collection, information about the collection, and even parts of the collection itself are available on the web so that our library patrons usually come in already knowing what they want to look at actually in person and handle. They're doing family history. They're doing house history. They're doing community history. They're trying to find their ancestors. And we have lots of students, especially at this time of year, young people coming in, middle schoolers to high schoolers, working on History Day projects. History Day has been epidemic in Minnesota. We have some 30,000 young people. We hear a lot about kids in trouble, but we don't hear about the fantastic kids who are doing absolutely phenomenal work. 30,000 kids in the state doing History Day projects. Last year, our kids have been incredibly competitive. Programs paid for both state and non-state dollars. Last year, when we got finally to the national competition, Minnesota kids went, and we took 5 out of the 14 first places, our Minnesota kids. Now, so to store that in your brain, 5 out of 14 first places went to Minnesota kids. That's pretty impressive when you look at the population of the state. Somebody's doing something right. We hold collections in trust for the people of Minnesota. We've got fantastic goods, an astounding collection of books, photographs. If any of you happen to be tuned in on the 21st and last night to Twin Cities Public Television, you saw a program called Minnesota History of the Land. That program was produced by the University of Minnesota and Twin Cities Public Television. We were major participants in that. Many, many of the images you saw came from the Society's collection. Some of the moving images had never even been shown before, including, for example, videotape of great conservationist Ernest Oberholzer. I think, Mr. Chair, we may have a clip.
Mr. Chair, you know, I was wondering when that was coming on, I'm sorry to follow, I missed it. Do you have copies of that? Has somebody taped it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Slawick, I'm sure there's videotape of that that would be available.
I would like to get one just to borrow or on a lending basis if I could, because I've just heard a lot about it that it was excellent, but I didn't know. I just missed two nights of it. So,
Mr. Chair, it's available.
When was this broadcast?
Last night and the night before at 8 o'clock, Monday and Tuesday.
You know, I only get to watch television when I'm home in Fairmont.
Right. Well, Mr. Chair, you're served in this case. It's available on a DVD, so we'll get information to you. But it's a fantastic piece of work that was done in which they used many, many images from our collections, both still images and moving images. They've also filmed at a number of our historic sites. They used the KSTP News Archive, which we have millions of feet of film provided to us by KSTP that go back to the founding of the station. In that case, there was the film footage that they provided that's in our collection now that related to the impact of the taconite industry on Minnesota's land. All of that is in this program, and I commend it to all of you, and it is available on DVD.
Is the Minnesota steel industry chronicled by what Representative Rocavina really says?
Mr. Chair, you have now left me speechless.
Yeah. You get to make that argument, Mr. Chair.
He makes it all the time. I just wonder how accurate he was.
Wonderful collections of maps, really a phenomenal collection of maps that show how early explorers began to understand the interior of our country, of this continent. Artworks coming into the collection we just were given an absolutely phenomenal Seth Eastman, which will be on exhibition. Newspapers. Ramsey had this idea. He thought newspapers were the day books of history. He wasn't thinking about the KSTP news collection, but he knew that newspapers were important. So we have millions of issues of newspapers, all the foreign language newspapers of the immigrants who came here newspapers as they're being produced today. Oral histories, we do oral histories. We're always engaged in projects trying to record both, in many cases with oral history, not only the spoken word, but usually these are done with visual materials. I spent a day recently with Earl Bakken, and one of the really wonderful things that we did, you probably know his name as the inventor of the pacemaker, and he and Walt Lillehei at the University of Minnesota were involved in the early, he provided the engineering, the electrical engineering, and Walt Lillehei did the work, of course, it was medical and surgical. And we made videotape of those two people, Dr. Lillehei when he was still alive, and Earl Bakken, talking about those first operations they were doing, and that was videotaped in the room where that work was done at the University of Minnesota. This has been shown, this material has been shown all over the country and borrowed, and is obviously a very important historical record that we have been involved in creating. We collect manuscripts, which are diaries and letters of people. We collect public records, I've mentioned earlier, artifacts. We've been talking a lot about the centennial of the state capitol. We have the trowel with which Alexander Ramsay laid the cornerstone, and archaeological objects, millions of them as well. It takes dollars and it takes people to do this work. In state support, in 2004, our reduced budget was at $22,407,000. The budget for fiscal 2005 is $22,280,000. This, by the way, does include the debt service on the History Center, which is not, most state agencies, I think, do not carry on their books, but we, which we do as a private entity, at $2.1 million. Also, you should be aware of the, to get the total financial picture, be aware of the non-state support that we have as well. Most recently, in last year, it was about $12 million in gifts, grants, and other revenues. This does not count capital dollars, but rather dollars that are expendable in a different way. In terms of staff, at this point, we have 182 full-time equivalent full-time people, and we have 178 full-time equivalent part-time people. The part-time people are the people whom you meet when you visit our historic sites, whether you're at the Lindbergh site or a Split Rock Lighthouse or at one of our other southern sites. And I mentioned that we have about 1,400 unpaid staff members who are volunteers. Every day and every year, we go about clearly making history. We are creating the past. And in that process, we lose some of the special people, people who are precious only to family, known only to family. But sometimes we lose people who are precious to the state itself, and that happened recently when we lost in November our former governor, Elmer Anderson, who was a great friend of the Minnesota Historical Society. He served as president of the society's governing board and maintained a long interest in the society. We have, for example, the diary of Josiah Snelling, thanks to Elmer Anderson, who was a great collector. He was giving things the month before he died. He sent over a brochure published in the, I think it was the 1870s, urging people to come to Minneapolis for the milling industry that was there. He had a keen sense of the importance of the society's work. And speaking about the society, he wrote these words: "There is no question that the values that built the past are essential to our future, but we cannot assume that they will be automatically adopted by future generations. The Minnesota Historical Society is a vital factor in preserving the best of the past and projecting it into the future." Before asking David to walk through the budget books, I want to just review for you very briefly where we are on some of the challenges that we have faced with the budget reduction of $4.3 million, following on a budget reduction of about $1 million, so down about $5.1 million in our annual appropriations. What this meant has been reductions in all areas of the society. It has not been, although the historic sites have attracted a lot of attention, it has affected every part of the institution. We have lost 24% of our full-time staff. These are staff members recruited from all over the country. I mentioned a close relationship with the Smithsonian Institution. We have had that relationship. We attract staff members from there, and people get recruited away from us to go there. In the case of Home Place Minnesota, for example, that piece, if you've seen it at the History Center, was done by an employee we recruited away from the Smithsonian. We brought him here, we trained him, we invested in him, and fortunately he is still with us. But a number of people who've come here and in whom we have invested, we have unfortunately had to say goodbye to. Certainly the reductions have been visible in our historic sites. You've all received communications, I'm sure, about them. These closings or threatened closings are very painful for the people in the areas affected. Seven sites are threatened, were threatened in through the budget cut of 03. One of them is closed, as you know, the Lower Sioux Agency, regrettably. We hope that someday that will turn around, and we have others that are literally on life support as local groups are trying very hard to raise the money needed to supplement the small amount of state dollars we're able to provide to them. The dollars are spread thin when you look at the program as a statewide program. Our hope was that there would be some relief in the 04 session, and I know that this committee did try to provide that relief, and we don't forget, we appreciate that greatly, and we hope that maybe there may be some opportunity to have another effort in that direction again. We hope that coming out of this session, we can at least achieve a modicum of stability. We are literally running on fumes in these places, kind of a week-to-week, hand-to-mouth operation, and that's not the way to operate it. We recognize the state's been in deep trouble, and we have done our part and tried to make things, whole things together as best we can, but we certainly hope there will be some relief coming along the way soon. We've put a few in at the History Center. I've done a few things that have been less popular than that. That's not very popular. It's not something I ever wanted to do. There's been pressure on us from some quarters to do that since before the History Center opened. I resisted every step of the way. But you come to a point when your History Center is closing at 3 o'clock in the afternoon because we don't have the money to run it, and we've got returning people away. I did not like coming into the building at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and seeing people, families arriving with children, often fathers, sometimes mothers, you know, clearly looking for something to do with their kids, and they turn around because the History Center is closed at 3 o'clock. That has changed. What we've been able to do with putting the fee on the History Center is we're going to try to take those dollars, whatever we take in, and pay for the extra hours and try to let people know that the place is there and available. The access questions, of course, are questions that trouble me a lot.
Director Archibald, I want you to know that cutting your budget was not a joy for me either. And when you look at this committee and the total cut that this committee's had, you've had a lesser cut. And I don't know what the total percentage of your total operating budget is, because you have two pockets of money that you use. You have the Historical Society's part as well as the state's part. It is not a fun time for any of us. I think our budget's been cut in total, I believe, 40%. I think 23 and 17 equals 40.
And this
has been a very miserable ride for a lot of us.
Mr. Chair, I am well aware of that. I can see the looks on faces, although I would not be a very good poker player myself. Some of you would not be either. And I have to say, as I look at faces, I can see very well that this is an agonizing process. And I've sat through hearings and watched the impact on a number of the other agencies that come before you, and I am well aware. And we're not here to complain. We're here to try to do the best we can and to make their case, because I think what we do is important, and I think most of you would agree that that is the case.
We so hope the bleeding will stop.
We hope the bleeding will stop for sure. In terms of anecdotal evidence about the fee, all I can tell you is not enough time to really tell. We are selling memberships. Mr. Chair, I really, at that point, this completes my part of the presentation, and we could move on to David and the budget books, but I would stop here and ask if any of you have specific questions you'd like to ask me at this moment.
I have a statement. I totally appreciate all the efforts of the Historical Society, and we are trying to start we do have a budget for our committee, and it's my intention to have a tour of the metro area, which I hope that you'll participate in this summer.
Mr. Chair, that would be great. We would love to have you see what it is that we do with the dollars we have.
I think the tour is growing, at least in my mind, and I'm sure I'll get a lot of input from the rest of the members. Over half of the members in this committee are from the metro area, and they certainly have a big story to tell all of us in our committee. Representative Clark, you've been here the longest in this committee.
So, pretty historical. I want to thank you for all your leadership and work in this area. I do think it's an incredible resource, and I'm sorry, and probably one of the sad people, that we are now charging all people to learn from this resource. And I think it was an agenda, Mr. Chair, of a previous chair of this committee, not you, to try to, you know, have the Historical Society pay, you know, take more, let me say, limit its access by having the public pay. I remember that was a discussion. Because there are other states who don't value history as much as we do, and they do it that way, therefore maybe we should consider doing it that way. don't know, it's just a, it's a philosophical question, I guess, and also really an equity question. But I have two real specific questions that have nothing to do with that issue. And just in looking at the documents here, and I was looking at the, this is a very helpful newsletter or journal or whatever you call this.
It's our, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, that's our publication that goes to our members.
Yeah. I'm a member, but I don't remember getting this. Well, anyway, the I just have a couple questions. One of them is, I see that, that there are a number of places where the Ojibwe language is being taught, and it looks like it's in Onamia in each of those cases. Very important work. I think we have a handful, maybe a couple dozen people who are fluent in Ojibwe. It's a language that's becoming obsolete unless we do things like this. So I'm glad that you're doing that. But I notice it's there, and I'm just wondering if at some point, last year we did pass a resolution, a bipartisan resolution, I think it was almost unanimous on the floor of the House, to have the Department of Education work with trying to preserve our native languages here in Minnesota. And I'm just wondering if there's some ways to work together with the Department of Education and bring it also into the metro area. I don't expect you with your limited resources to do that, but I just want to just put that on the table as a request maybe to think about how we could do that. It should be something throughout the whole state, of course.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to just respond very quickly and say the Society's Governing Board passed a strategic plan last March, and among the elements of that plan was a commitment to the preservation of the languages of our native people. One of the Society's vice presidents, I think we have three or four, is a native woman who teaches at the University of Minnesota, and she's been a powerful advocate for the language preservation. And one of the planned things that we have in mind for Fort Snelling in the future, when we're able to revitalize that incredible resource that we have, is to run language classes out there. So we're looking at the whole issue of running language, teaching languages. We've made a number of publications. We published Ojibwe and Dakota language dictionaries so that we're doing what we can to keep these languages alive. And I think your warning is a good one. We are working at Mille Lacs. The Society operates the Mille Lacs Indian Museum on the Mille Lacs Reservation. Some of you may have read in the morning about their treaty, which is the treaty celebration, I think, which was yesterday, wasn't it, the 22nd, David?
Oh.
Celebrating an important treaty for that community. But in any case, we work closely with Native people and certainly are very committed to language preservation. The notion of working with the Department of Education is an interesting idea for us to explore.
And one other quick question, Mr. Chair. I was looking at the photo on the last page of the same document. Can you tell me about the person who, the way the photo is taken, looks, they have the cornerstone on his back, but that person and the person behind them, did you say that one of these is Ramsey, or who are those individuals? Do we know from the historical record?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I can't identify the people in this photograph at this moment. We would certainly be willing to try to get to you. Ramsey did lay the cornerstone for the state capitol, and I don't know which pair of feet are his. If it's the feet we're looking at here, seems to be. So we could try to find out who these are, but identifying individuals, good lesson to us all. When you have your family photographs, write on the back of them who's in them and when they were taken, because we get boxes of photographs that come to us, and we have no idea who the people are. I think it's going to be a challenge for us to identify the people here, but we're willing to give it a shot. Mr. Chair, I just would say make one other comment in relation to Representative Clark's comment about access. I think the Society, in my own mind, and Jim Knobloch put it in words when I was visiting with him, Representative Knobloch, recently. He said, we like to think of the Historical Society as the Smithsonian Institution of Minnesota. And for those of you who've been to Washington, you know that access is the name of the game. It doesn't cost anything to go to any of those places. And so if we dream about a fair day, we could dream about a day when we will not be where we are and we'll be able to provide that access to all people at no cost.
Representative Westerberg, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Director Archibald. Perhaps, well, first I should mention, you know, we're family members of these, the organization here, and enjoy the fact, you know, being able to get around to see these different sites. But my question is, and you may want Mr. Kelleher to answer this, but in looking at the rest of the book here a little bit, they talk about the number of tendons, you know, at these different places, and in going through the book, do you evaluate each of these places as far as the number of attendants for people showing up to see if it makes sense, you know, obviously to continue
Mr. Chair, Representative Westerberg, David can give you more, Mr. Kelleher, more specific information, but I can tell you certainly we look at attendance figures and we know what they are. I also, and I would tell you that if you look at the attendance, for example, at a site that closed, the Lower Sioux Agency, you're looking at attendance that would be probably below 10,000 in any case. The reality of life is that I think you could probably put the marketing budget of Marshall Fields at that site and you still would not attract 100,000 people. It's simply out of the way. On the other hand, history doesn't only happen in the Twin Cities, and while these are certainly tourist amenities and amenities in general for all of us, cultural amenities, they are also very significant historic places. And so in a place like the Lower Sioux Agency, I would argue that we, whether or not we attract 10,000 people or 50,000 people, this is a very important place in the state's history, and it's a place that the state of Minnesota ought to take responsibility for. If we can't open it to the public at this moment, that's where we are. But these are important historic places. Certainly we're aware of who goes where. The Twin City sites and Split Rock Lighthouse and the state capitol will always trump the others in terms of what numbers of people they're able to attract. I would also say, however, that these sites are extremely important to the local people. If you've talked to any of the people from Forestville, from the Preston area, about how important the Forestville Historic Site and State Park are to them, they will tell you. They would make the argument, I suspect, that Forestville is more important to them than Fort Snelling is to the Twin Cities from an economic standpoint, even though Fort Snelling will attract, you know, many tens and tens and tens of times the number of visitors that could go to the site near Preston.
Dr. Ball, I can attest to that by my emails and messages.
Mr. Chair, I'm not surprised.
Mr. Chairman, if I may add, first of all, my name is Bill Keyes. I'm the head of Historic Sites and Museums for the Minnesota Historical Society. And on the question of attendance at sites, this is something we monitor very closely. We find that at some sites, we've had visitation as low as less than 1,000 people a year, and then you really have to struggle with the question of does it warrant the cost. And some of these sites, though, the numbers are much higher, and one by one, every year, we make that evaluation. It was instrumental in some recent changes in program. But of course, as Director Archibald said, that the question of the value to the local community is a really important one in balancing those various components of the financial cost, the historic significance, and the importance to the local community is something we have to face every day.
Mr. Chair, in some of the smaller sites in the local communities, we've been able to enter into agreements with local organizations. The work has been done ahead of time. The site is in good enough physical shape, thanks to the work that you've enabled us to do, that we're able to rely on local people. For example, up at the site in Moorhead, Comstock House, there we were able to enter into an agreement with the city of Moorhead. The site is relatively simple, and it can be managed. It's in reasonable shape at this point, not perfect by any means. It's got some needs, but between our dollars, the city of Moorhead, and some dollars that are coming from descendants of the Comstock family, we're able to run that relatively simple site through a management agreement. You are never going to run the Oliver Kelly Farm, however, on a management agreement when you're dealing with animals that are bred back, all the issues that surround running an active farm. This obviously requires something different.
Certainly, I recognize that the seven sites that are open to the public but are managed by others were at one time all on the sites that you had oversight over.
Mr. Chair, of those seven at this point, the Comstock House, Fort Ridgely, are the two that would have gone to management agreements. Is that correct out of the seven? And five others are still struggling. Bill, maybe you can speak to that.
Mr. Chairman, a number of these historic sites have been in management agreements. There are seven sites, and some of these agreements date back as many as 10 and 15 years. In the last, within the last biennium, there were the Comstock House, as Director Archibald mentioned, as well as Fort Ridgely, those two became management agreement sites. And typically those are handled with some level of funding that comes from through the Historical Society and state dollars, but most of the funding for those sites is raised locally. They also use money that they get from admissions, from people coming to the door.
Mr. Chair, it might be helpful for the committee to know which sites at this moment are very much endangered. Phil, you want to review those, please?
Yes. The seven sites that we've been talking about, there is the Forest History Center, there is the Hill House, the Oliver Kelly Farm, Lower Sioux Agency, which, as we mentioned, is currently closed, Fort Ridgely, and Forestville, and also the Comstock House.
I was in the room. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Archibald. We've had some discussions. We won't pursue those here on tape, but could you tell the committee what the Historical Society will save, the dollar figures that they'll save, if you, in the end, actually have to close more these sites that you just mentioned, the ones that are in danger?
I'm going to call on David to give you the specific numbers, but I think one of the things for the committee members to be aware of is at this point we are putting very, very few state dollars in these sites. They're being used, the dollars are sufficient to provide security, to provide the basic level of care. You have a stewardship responsibility that you share with us. We can't simply board these places up and walk away. But I'll actually refer to David and Bill. Bill, you want to handle the specifics on the numbers?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative, right now the way that these seven sites are funded is that they have, each of them, a base amount of state dollars. And that state dollars is calibrated site by site to cover things like their security systems, their phone lines, which are connected to the security systems, mowing the grass, things that we would have to do even if the sites were closed. So we went one by one and calculated that. All of the additional costs of operating these historic sites comes from public fundraising and activities at these sites, as well as the admissions that they take in the front door. So the amount of savings, if they were closed, actually wouldn't be anything, because we have the responsibility to continue to preserve these facilities, whether they're open or closed. So right now we're at the point where we are paying to keep them in place, but the closing them wouldn't save us any additional dollars.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe one of the testifiers can tell us, and I've had some private conversations in my office and in the hallways. You've alluded to the fact that many of the donors that are helping you maintain these sites are in advance, I'm trying to be kind here, but I guess are getting older. That's the best way to put it. Do you have an average age of the people that are helping you keep these seven sites open, or the age of the donor? And the reason I ask that is that, you know, these volunteers, if they're 20 is one thing, but if they're 85, they're, you know, certainly coming to a point where that's not what they want to do with the rest of their lives. Or in the same fashion, if your donors, the majority of the donors that are keeping these sites open are, you know, 80 or 85 and coming towards the end of their life, they may not be so willing to donate at a later date. So I guess what I'm trying to find out is some of your plans here or some of your ideas.
Mr. Chair, age is only one factor in all of this. I think I can give you one very potent example recently. John Weaver was becoming very, very interested in trying. He's Mr. Anoka History, passionately interested in history, and a good and long-time friend of the Minnesota Historical Society. I went out to Anoka on a number of occasions to help them to celebrate various things that he had been behind. He was in the process of, with the local banker, Ed Babcock, trying to put together, help each other, challenge each other. And as many of you probably know, another one of those public deaths we all experienced was the death of John Weaver in November. So it does happen. Elmer Anderson being another one. In terms of the people who raise the money for these sites, I don't know. I would guess the average age maybe is around 50, something like that, 55. They're running out of time as much as anything to do this. In the case of somebody I know came before this committee, Steve Rolfe, the city of Elk River apparently allowed him some sort of time, paid time away to work to try to raise the money to try to keep that site open. And they're still trying. But in the case of the Kelly Farm, the amount of money that they've been able to raise, the same thing is true at Forestville. The local people are saying, we came to the rescue here once. we can't do this again and again. So you've got a compounding problem of diminishing energy on the people who were actually raising the money and diminishing interest on the part of the people who were willing to come on a one-time rescue basis and try to help. This is a serious matter. You're right. It's a compounding problem. Bill, maybe you could add to it.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, there are a couple of factors, as Nina has mentioned. And one of them is, for example, with the Oliver Kelly Farm, that is a site that's very family-oriented. If you go out to the farm, you'll find that very often there are more kids than there are adults around, and that the people who support that farm, many of them have young families. And so there's, if you go to other sites, you'll find often that they are older members of the community. But all of the communities where these sites reside do value them. They recognize the importance of the historic sites to their economic well-being, and they also recognize this as a place that has true meaning for them because it records some aspect of their lives and continues to hold a warm place in their hearts. However, people who have now been on the fundraising trail for over 2 years and are facing a third fiscal year of fundraising, they're basically saying, they're using words like exhausted. Among them, I've heard people who said that they have every weekend for 2 years have been involved in some sort of effort, whether it was visiting a potential donor, holding a fundraising event, attending some sort of special thing, that they are just exhausted. Their families want them back, they tell me. That they have, they feel like they've done their share, they've held up their end of the bargain, and now they're looking for help elsewhere. And this is not just true at the Kelly Farm. We've heard it also at Forestville and at other places. They also are having difficulty. They're going back to the same well every year. And so they're asking the same people for money every year, and they're getting less and less success. In fiscal 04, we saw fundraising occurring at sites of a certain level, and in fiscal 05, in almost every instance, that had dropped down to a third of what they were able to raise the first year. So I'm guessing that the third year, it's certainly going to drop lower again. And they just can't keep going back to the same well again for more.
Representative Slawick and then Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question regarding that, and I'm sympathetic, and I think you're doing a good job, but I'm struggling a little bit with your fundraising stuff because my background's in fundraising, and I look at your named endowment funds, your deferred gifts, your bequests, your memorials, and your gifts, and it looks like you've done a tremendous job securing a broad base of donors at a variety of levels. Frankly, closing sites has a bit of a political feel to me. You know, when you have all of these donors, and there's hundreds in this report, hundreds, and then to tell us you're going to close sites, seems a bit of a shove and push here. We know there's wealthy Minnesotans that are interested in the History Museum, and I'm sure you know just who they are.
Right.
And when the state is in tough times like this, we do have to ask people to step up. So I'm sympathetic, but I see an awful lot of donors here, hundreds, and very wealthy people and corporations. And how have you had an aggressive, you know how you do these things, you should have endowments for them. You should have endowments to sustain these sites at big dollar levels so you don't have to go and have chicken dinners. You know, and so, and I see them here. I see you have a number of endowment funds. So what's the big picture and the big donors? And they're stepping up. I mean, we know the good thing about sometimes when people get older is they die and leave bequests.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the bequest picture? Have you got some coming down the road?
Mr. Chair, Representative Swarwood, we do have a pretty aggressive fundraising program. And we are continuing to be aggressive. The board has made a commitment. I made a reference to the strategic plan. They're going to be looking at our donor base. We have 2,500 members who've been members for 15 years or more. That's a fantastic donor base. Our average age of members is over 50. So we've got those possibilities. We do have a planned giving program. But the notion about planned giving is that the
just don't, in fundraising language, don't mature until the people die. And so you may enter an agreement with someone, but it may take 10 or 15 years before the dollars become available to you. Private fundraising has been a big piece, not only the chicken dinners, but there has been, I think I've mentioned to some of you in meetings, that there's been a private donor, actually a Twin Cities person, who is not a wealthy name that you would recognize on that list, a person who's well known in Minnesota, but he is so passionate about historic sites that over the last 3 years, he has put $204,000 of his own dollars into this, and he has quietly challenged the local groups to try to raise money. So we are funneling fundraising dollars in there, and we are raising endowments. But these have not been easy times for raising money. The impact on the endowment of the down market, where just yesterday I was looking at our numbers, talking to Patrick McCormick, and it looks like we're back to our historic high. Maybe we're approaching it to basically about $30 million in endowment. We're aggressive about it, but you cannot, at the rate in which the state has been emptying the money bucket, we've not been able to fill it fast enough. We've been aggressive on the annual fund, asking our people to increase the amount of the annual fund by 20-25% per annum, asking board members to put challenges out there so that we get other people to join. For every increased gift, they'll give a dollar. We're doing it all. But it's, as I said, we can't fill the bucket fast enough to replace the dollars going out. And I might also say that while the historic sites have been the place where it's been visible, actually, two-thirds of the cuts have been taken right here in St. Paul, the infrastructure itself, and the services which make these sites go. These sites are not freestanding entities. They don't have their own HR departments, their own finance departments, their own education departments per se. They are fed by the resource here in St. Paul. They are a satellite operation. So it's not a matter of simply being able to say, oh, yes, we just made a political ploy and went after the sites. It's hardly the case.
Mr. Chair, I figured you would respond like that, but it's tough for us, too. And it's tempting to say, for Mr. Kelleher's salary, you could save a historic site or something, and to do trade-offs like that. I know it's tough times, but we that was a, how many would that say?
I told him a little site.
but we want him around too.
I didn't know you represented Marshall.
But we just, it's not quite close, obviously. I know it's very competitive out there for a number of organizations, but a lot of the things we deal with don't have the ability to raise money.
We understand that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Kelleher, we're going to have your part probably delivered to our office in a written form. I think we already have it.
Oh. Mr. Chairman, what I was going to do is simply walk through the budget books, which you have
we
in your
have
notebooks.
Already, yeah.
That information is fairly straightforward. It describes the general fund expenditures that we receive from the state through you, and outlines in some greater detail what those expenditures are. And if you have any quick questions, I can answer them, but I think the numbers in the budget books speak for themselves.
Certainly it's your defense, so we don't want to take your salary away to save a site. Mr. Keller is probably one of the most available governmental resource persons we have, and he will be available to answer any questions any member has.
All right, we'll be coming
just
around.
Just look for the red hair.
We'll be coming around to visit with all of you, and any of you who've got questions after you've looked through the specific numbers, we're certainly happy to answer them. And we'd be happy to talk further about the fundraising program, which is about as aggressive as I know how to make one.
One more question?
A quick clarification question. On the budget, it says $4.23 per Minnesotan per year to preserve our history. Is that to preserve the current budget, or is that to get it to what it used to be, or what...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, the $4.23 figure is the current expenditures on...
Mr. Chair, what I would ask is, since this, what would it take? Is it maybe $5 a year to get us back to having some of the... replacing some of the... Can you just give us that number at some point? This is a prospective kind of point, Mr. Chair, because we're going to be dealing with... I presume we're going to be dealing with a stadium and some other... requests that go through here, and I hope we're equally tough on them in terms of some of the private expectations. And I guess less than $5, I'd just like to know what it would be, and maybe that would help us in our discussion.
Very well.
Thank you.
I agree.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And with that, we're adjourned.